Well, welcome to another edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. As usual, I'm your host, William Hill, and today is February 23rd, 2016. This is broadcast number 105. And as I was talking with our guest, who is going to be Pastor Brian Croft, and we're going to talk with him in just a minute about a number of issues related to pastoral ministry, as I was just talking with him, I've just come back from a trip to Colorado, and I don't know what happened. I think it's the whole plane experience. And those of you who listen to this podcast all the time know that I just love to fly and, not really. And I think I brought something back with me from Colorado. So who knows what it is, but my throat has been bugging me ever since. So if people are listening and have listened quite often and sense that maybe I don't sound as normal as I usually do, if that's possible, that's the reason. But anyway. But the nice thing about our guest today is that he's done podcasts before, and he's written extensively and talked much about pastoral ministry. He's been in the ministry for over 20 years, and so we're going to be talking with a man who's done this before, so hopefully he'll talk more and I'll talk less, and after all, you don't want to hear me, really. Anyway, so anyway, just a few things that bring everybody up to speed with what we're doing here at the podcast. As you know, my assistant is working feverishly to bring more and more guests on from different areas and aspects of Christian theology and practical ministry type things. And so we're going to be talking with some men in the future leading up to the Banner of Truth Ministers Conference that is held every year in the great state of Pennsylvania. So look forward to that down the road, but we are currently scheduling some men for that to help the Banner conference more exposure. And so look forward to that in the future. Now, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking with Pastor Brian Croft. He is the pastor of Auburndale Baptist Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and he's been in pastoral ministry for a little over 20 years now. So Pastor Croft, Brian, it's good to have you on the program. And I've been, like I told you off air, I've been looking forward to talking with you for quite a while, and so I'm really excited about this particular program and the things that you bring to the equation when it comes to pastoral ministry. But welcome, and thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Now, Brian, you're a new guest, of course, on the program, and so I suspect many of the listeners know of you or have heard of you, but now's your chance to tell our listeners your background, how you came to faith in Christ, what are you currently doing, married, children, all that good stuff.
Okay. So I became a Christian when I was 13 years old. I grew up in a church that didn't preach the gospel faithfully, but I heard the gospel at a youth event where three students from a local college came in and did a lock-in, and I heard the gospel in the middle of the night through them. Mm-hmm. But the challenge with that is being in a church that was not faithful to the gospel and wasn't faithful to disciple people. My teenagers were rough in different ways, but certainly in trying to just learn how to grow as a Christian and not having a whole lot of help, you know, to do that. But I ended up going to college at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee, pursuing music there. And it was there where I kind of had a crisis of faith, just my own faith becoming my own, not my parents'. Mm-hmm. And in the process of walking through that pretty lonely, dark time, I felt what I seemed to be some kind of calling to the ministry. Now, I hadn't been mentored well at all, hadn't been discipled well. All I knew is, like, I loved Jesus and I loved people. And that's about all I knew. And ministry was appealing in some way. I was in no position to pursue ministry. I didn't know what I know now, looking back on it, and God was kind just to protect me to not do something really horrific in the early years. But I had an opportunity to go on staff at a church back home. And so I did that. And that's kind of what started my, my ministry, and was on staff at, doing associate work at several churches for about 8.5 years. And all four churches that I served on, some were short, like internship 1 year stints. So they weren't meant to be long. Every place I went, I had this desire to be mentored. I realized what I didn't know. And every pastor I worked with didn't see it as their role to do that. And so I grew discouraged in just wanting to be taught what I didn't know. And so I learned some really hard, painful lessons the hard way as a young man in ministry. Looking back on that, God's providence, that was a good way to learn. And it also, my desire to be mentored and not receive that, at least from the pastors that I was, gave me a real burning desire to want to be able to mentor others when I was in the position to be able to do that. I also had a couple pastors on the outside of the churches I served in. They actually, I think, felt pity for me and took me in. And I was mentored by pastors outside the churches that I was serving in. But that just developed my deep conviction and need for pastors to be mentored by other pastors. And so, which really caused, which God had plans that I didn't know for me to be doing a ministry now that does a lot of that. So the church I'm at now, Auburndale, my senior pastor there for 12 and a half years. And in the process of that 12 and a half years and mentoring just young men in my church, I took a typical dead dying Southern Baptist church with 30 elderly members in it. And the Lord just saw fit to bring new life to our church in that time. And through that time, the Lord sent some young men who wanted to pursue ministry. And so I just vowed to the Lord when I went there. I said, if you send anybody here who wants to pursue ministry, that I will do all I can to be faithful to mentor and care for them. And that's what I did. So I just started dragging them to the hospitals and taking them to the funeral homes and taking them to visit the widows and involving them in my sermon prep. And that's kind of how that an informal internship in our church started. And out of that, a ministry called Practical Shepherding just kind of emerged. The practical elements of ministry, there's this giant void in resources for them. It certainly was several years ago. And that got exposed in when I was doing some of these things and started writing about it a little bit online. And so a blog started out of that. I had an opportunity. I'm not a writer, and I wrote a book just on hospital visitation because my interns at church had asked me to write some of the stuff down I was teaching them. And that turned into a book that was published by a small publisher, and none of us expected anything to happen with it. But what it did is expose this gaping hole in practical resources, and that opened a lot of doors to write more. And that's how Practical Shepherding just kind of, about 4 years ago, became a full-fledged nonprofit. And so my time was split between now being senior pastor of Auburndale and then this ministry, Practical Shepherding, which is training pastors and mentoring pastors. And we're trying to just juggle all that now. And then last summer, I assumed a role of senior fellow of Mathena Center for Church Revitalization here at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. So that's my third hat. So I have a juggling act I continue to try to do every day of my life.
But, it sounds like it.
But it is all fluid. So all three of these things run together. You know, the church I went into was a revitalization church situation. And so learned a lot through that. And so all three of these things really fit well together. So in a lot of ways, I feel like I kind of have the dream job, at least the things that are my passions and what God's called me to.
Yeah, it's a great story. It's just interesting to see the things that you weren't getting in the early days now have blossomed into the things that now you're placing in the hands of other men. I know I was familiar with your ministry work and some of the writings anyway a number of years ago. And as I mentioned earlier, I was pushing here at Greenville Seminary to have you come on the program because obviously as a seminary, one of the things that we're real passionate about at Greenville is preaching. But as you well know, there's more to ministry than just standing in the pulpit. And though as essential and critical as that is, it's the hospital visits, it's the sitting with the dying and ministering to people in those circumstances it's tough to learn by reading a book. And in fact, it's almost impossible, I think, to learn it just by reading a book.
Yeah.
You have to live and experience those things. And so it's interesting to hear your story and how God has brought you from what you weren't receiving, that void, and now trying to put it in the hands of men in a very practical, very practical way. So, great story. And thanks for sharing.
Isn't it amazing? That's how God, how kind God is. He really does work everything for our good in that.
Yep.
And I remember just being very discouraged in those years. Like, look, I want to be taught. I'm teachable. I want to learn. And there was just no one to do it. And but God knew all along that that's what he was going to use to really light a fire in me to want to do that for others and really wave the banner for pastors to, it's our responsibility in the local church to train pastors. Theological education is wonderful and something that is necessary, but that's not where guys really learn how to do ministry. And so we're trying to, we're just trying to wave the banner of, in the local church with real people in real life is where you learn how to be a pastor.
Yep, absolutely. Totally agree. I'm the gentleman that you've been emailing back and forth with, he'll be embarrassed for me to say this, but that's too bad. He actually rents a room for me, for those who don't know, as he's going to seminary. But and it's a joy to know him. He's a very outstanding young man. And anyway, I've taken him on occasion to a hospital when I had occasion to do so. And I told him the same thing. I said, this is where the rubber hits the road, brother. Right. I said, you can spend 30 hours preparing sermons, and that's important. And I don't downplay that by any means. It's very critical. But I tell you right now, these visits, this is the stuff, this is the tough stuff. Preparing sermons, I mean, it's hard, but no one interrupts me. It's just me and my books and in prayer. But when you go to a hospital and you have no idea what's going to happen next, and you feel completely inadequate half the time, most of the time, I do, and feel like you've done nothing. I've come home from hospitals and visits with families in very dark places, and I've said to my wife, I don't think I did anything. I said, I don't think I did. She always tells me, but you were there.
That's right.
You were there. And anyway, well, we could talk all about that for now until forever. But what I want to talk about today, I think, though we're talking about the pastoral ministry in general, and that's your passion, and you've blogged about it at practicalshepherding.com. For those who don't know, practicalshepherding.com is the website. And if you're driving right now, you can't write it down. You can go to the confessingourhope.com website. I have that information all there. So either way, you can get it. But you wrote a book a couple years ago. I think it was 2013
right.
was when it came out, on the pastor's family. And it's a very interesting, important subject because it is so easy, I think, in the ministry for men to lose sight of the reality that they have wives, they have kids, and they were probably called to minister to them first before they were ever called to minister to a church. And so in this book, you deal with a number of those issues. Why don't you tell us the background to the book? Why did you write it? And who'd you write it with?
Yeah.
Because I don't think you mentioned your wife. And so here's your chance to talk about her a little, too.
Yeah, sure. My wife, Kara, wrote the book with me. I've been married 19 years. And she's just a real gift. I got four kids. Age range is from 16 to 9. And so, when the book had a couple of motivations. One was in my work with Practical Shepherding, especially, just seeing the pastor's family imploding all over the place. Really burdened by that. And seeing in Scripture all over the place, really. I mean, specifically 1 Timothy 3, those qualifications that Paul writes to Timothy on what pastor is supposed to be. There is the prerequisite that a man cares well for his household and cares for his wife and his kids. And I think that we just lose sight of that. And there's so many reasons and implications of that. But I think men are generally narcissistic in the way we approach ministry. And so we get focused on our ministry. We find our identity in it. We find a lot of, affirmation in it. And that there are just all kinds of reasons that revolve around that cause us to neglect our family. So wanting to write something that really I had not seen anywhere else, at least written in a modern context, and be able to address what are the hard issues that causes a pastor to neglect his family? What does that do to his family? And what are the ways to safeguard that and have a real change take place in a pastor's family's life? So, there's that. There's the burden of the spiritual implications. I mean, the enemy is so cunning. I mean, he has figured out that if he can destroy the pastor's family, that he can destroy a pastor's ministry, his family, and his church potentially in one fell swoop. And so, no wonder he goes after the pastor's family. So I think the pastor's family is on the front lines of this kind of spiritual warfare. The other reason to write the book, and this isn't necessarily a great idea to write a book, but just kind of the way it worked, is my wife and I are trying to figure it out. And you can write a book book can be compelling from two perspectives. One is writing out of a lot of experience and being someone who has done the work. I have a friend of mine who is a pastor for 50 years who just wrote me yesterday, asked me to endorse his book, and he wrote a book about basically the things he learned in 50 years of ministry. Like, I'm going to read that book. I'm going to read it carefully.
Yeah.
And that every young pastor should. The other reason to write is just write at, like, because you're in the middle of it and you're trying to figure it out. And you write it in such a way, not that you're an expert, but you write it in such a way that, look, I'm really trying to figure this out. We are trying to figure this out. And hopefully the goal was, and my wife's part of the book is definitely better and the best part of it. So, it's written in such a way, it's written in an informal way to where hopefully she and I are having a dialogue about these different things that we've just faced and that we're trying to figure out that we don't have all the answers to. We talk about some of the things we've learned and some of the things we feel like we don't know yet. So we wrote the book in the middle of a couple of my kids becoming teenagers, we're out of the baby stage. We're moving into teen years. I got a couple kids who aren't teenagers yet. So we're really in the thick of parenting and family life, school. So my wife homeschooled for 10 years and it slowly crushed her. And so we've had to try to make some adjustments with schooling, as that took place. My wife has battled depression off and on most of her life. And probably one of the most profitable things in the book is that what she was courageous enough to write about it in the back of the book, because I feel like it's generally not okay for a pastor's wife to struggle.
Right.
And that's really sad, but that's the perspective. And pastors' wives feel that. And I think many pastors' wives, just as I work with many of them, they are really struggling. Many of them are battling depression. Ministry's hard. Family life's hard in the ministry. And but they don't feel a safety to be able to verbalize it and to make
it. That's a great point. As most listeners know, I've been married almost 28 years, and like you, as you said about your wife, my wife's an extreme gift to me, and I don't come anywhere close to deserving her. And those who know my wife know that that's probably absolutely 100% true. My background and things, but why do you think the pastor's wives especially wrestle with the reality of being open about, you know, they're sinners. They struggle with sin just like everybody else. And why do you think that is? Others just seem to have less of a problem with it in the church, but the pastor's wives, for some reason or another, just seems like they're in a corner and they're supposed to be insulated from all this business.
Yeah, it's an excellent question, Bill. So a couple of things come to mind. I mean, there's a lot, but I think one of the big things is most pastors' wives love their husbands. Want to be a help to them in their ministries. And so do not want to do something that would be a hindrance to them. Mm. So they sense this expectation that somehow the pastor and the pastor's wife and the pastor's family are supposed to have it all together, you know, and not struggle like regular folks. And she feels this pressure to have to perform and show that image because she doesn't want to harm her husband's ministry. And she thinks that that will do it. I think there's pressure from a lot of husbands on their wife because the pastor's feeling that pressure.
Yep.
They put that pressure on them. So I think the combination of them already feeling the pressure from the church and then feeling the pressure from their husbands that, no, we've got to do this and do that because of how it'll look or, you know, those kind of things. That, I think both of those things just can crush a pastor's wife. Because she doesn't want to be a hindrance to her husband's ministry. She loves him. She wants to be a help to him. Mm-hmm. And so I have found, and this is part of, my wife and I went through a pretty dark journey. It's interesting in God's amazing providence that we wrote this book trying to figure these things out. And right around the time the book was published, that my wife and I hit a really dark time in all this kind of coming to a head. I had started traveling more and, again, the schooling, my children was just crushing my wife. My ministry schedule was just killing her. And she was feeling like I was not listening to her cries for help, and I wasn't. So we entered a really dark time. We actually spent 2 years together in counseling. with a counselor that was just a gift to us and helped us work through some of these things. So I bring this up just to go ahead and acknowledge, you know, the best thing a pastor can do to for his wife is to be open and transparent with the church and encourage her to have the freedom to be who she is in the church. And a lot of times the pastor will do that with his wife, that she will feel freedom to be able to do that more. But a lot of times it comes from the men, and many pastors are very unaware of that. And that's what's so harmful about it. Quite frankly, I was unaware of it for a long time in my own marriage. So I think that's the chief reason why many pastors' wives feel crushed by these things, these expectations and pressures. And I think it's part of the husband leading. A pastor will lead his family in a way. He looks at his wife and says, "You do today what you need to do. I know it's Sunday, I know you were up half the night with one of our kids and camp folks. If you need to go to my office and sit there during Sunday school because you just need some silence and prepare for worship, please do that.
Absolutely.
If people complain, I'll deal with it.
That's right.
I'll deal with
Absolutely.
It. That's not your problem. I want you to do what you need to do. Man, there are so many pastors' wives that feel so empowered by that and loved by their husbands if they did that.
Yeah, you know, my wife and I had a conversation because she's in nursing, and we talked a little bit about this image issue that you're discussing, and I have a pretty strong personality, so you know I'm like, well, don't worry about it, you know, I'll deal with it kind of thing. You know, it sounds great when you're talking in private, but when you're pressured by the congregation or the members in certain ways, but we were talking about this very issue. And she says, "Well, you know, if I'm an RN and I'm working in a hospital, it's possible I could be working on Sundays, which strong, strict Sabbatarian that we are, and Lord's Day issues." And she asked me that question. She goes, "How's that going to look?" This was her question. How's that going to look to the congregation if I'm working in a hospital every Sunday when you're preaching every Sunday?
Yep.
And I said, "Dear, look, number one, we're not there yet. That's one.
Yep.
Number two, there's nothing wrong with you working in a hospital. People get sick on the Lord's Day. And we'll deal with that, but I'll deal with that with the church and understanding with the elders. This is the situation." Now, in God's providence, things change, and we're not going to be in that situation. But there's other types of situations like that. And I think the point you're making, which is really great, is that the pastor needs to be open and honest with his congregation that, look, my wife is not she's a member of this church like every other woman in the church.
Right.
And she can't possibly, she's not sinless.
Yep.
She's going to struggle with things just like the pastor struggles with things. We just had a member at a church that I've been state of supply for almost a year now, make that comment to me that, you know, I've come to the realization that pastors struggle with sin just like everybody else. I said,
amazing thought.
Yeah, imagine that. And it wasn't, you know, it's not a negative thing for her to say that. I'm glad to hear people make that comment because we do. But then there's that image issue that we're always trying to present this best side of our lives, and we should be at one level, but the realization that oftentimes we put our wives through these great difficulties unknowingly, as you've said.
Well,
and
we give lip service to we preach it to our people that we're supposed to find our identity in Christ.
Yep.
And if a pastor would really embrace that and really be willing to dig deep in the deep dark places of his soul and realize how that is not the case, that he is driven by people's approval. He's driven by what people think, and he puts that on his wife. That will slowly crush her. And what it eventually does is it crushes your family to where you potentially disqualify yourself and aren't able to serve in the ministry anymore.
Yep. So what's the solution? How did you and your wife, and maybe as you're talking with the listeners, some guys training for the ministry, not necessarily at Greenville, but whatever, wherever they may be. I recently read an article, when I say recently, last two or three years, of a man who, and perhaps you're familiar with this article, or even the man, who lost his wife in seminary because he'd neglected her.
Yeah.
He, you know, had lots of friends, everything was great with his friends, but his wife was not being shepherded at all, and she left him. And it was a sad article to read, frankly, but also a great warning. So what's the solution? How do you deal with that?
Yeah. Well, from a biblical standpoint, the solution is to identify what what's going on in the heart of the pastor, mm-hmm. and why he neglects his family, his wife. And that has to be, so it, I think what every pastor needs to realize is this is not about his wife and how helpful or unhelpful she is or what his kids are like. It has to be, it has to be about with the pastor. And he's got to deal with his own heart. He's got to deal with the fact that the problem in neglect is not the demands and pressures of ministry, which we love to blame. It's actually the sin in the pastor's heart. It causes him to be drawn to these things and not find his identity in Christ. And so the solution is, it's nothing earth shattering, but it's what is the solution, and that's the gospel. You know, God's grace in the gospel has to permeate these places in the pastor's soul to be able to, not be driven by what the deacon's opinion of you, regardless of what you do, or whether you're doing things to try to please folks. It has to be driven by just doing what's right, what needs to be done, and to be okay with if people criticize you, because it may come down to it that your being home for dinner with your wife and family mm-hmm. might be the most important thing, and then you can get to the hospital later. And so I think the solution is to know, you know, you don't want to just kind of have behavior modification with this stuff and grit your teeth and go, well, this is the right thing, I need to do it. You need to deal with the heart and what your desires are and what's driving yeah. that. And that will help you, be able to make better decisions and know that your wife and your family has to come first. And I have found that when I was not doing this well, and then I started improving as I just come to deal with some of these things in my own soul, I found that when I am fully present with my family and when I make them the priority that they're supposed to be, they are all more than willing to give me up when I really need to go to the hospital that night.
Yep. Isn't that the truth?
But when you don't give them, when you're not present with them, when you're not giving them your full attention and you're engaged with them.
Yep. Bitterness starts creeping in.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yep.
Yeah. So,
yeah. I my wife has made that comment even in seminary. And my wife, like I said before, I mean, she's incredibly patient. But I got a wake up call early on last semester because I'm preaching every week, taking a lot of classes, trying to get done, graduate in May, and just very busy.
Yeah.
And they're all good things as you've talked about. But she sent me an email. It wasn't even a verbal conversation. I mean, it was an email. She figures I know how to reach him. I'll email him because I have my email, you know, on my hip. I have it everywhere I go.
Yeah.
And she says something about, you know, it's important for us to spend, you know, go out on a date once a week. It was something to that effect.
Yeah.
And it's all it said. It wasn't a criticism. It wasn't an attack. It was just a reminder. And I wrote her back right away, and I said, I really appreciate this. I fear that I've neglected you because of everything that I'm doing that's good, but I've neglected my wife.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was her way of – and she wrote me back right away, and she said, I don't feel like you're neglecting me. I just want you to remember that you're married.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
So we put it on the calendar, and we make – it's a conscious thing now that we do every week, and recognizing that emergencies are going to come up just like you talked about, but now when they do, it's not as difficult to say, hey, I have a member in the church that's dying, and I need to be there.
Yeah, Bill, I found that as I was doing, you know, I started doing my own soul work, a lot of this happened through our counseling that we did with someone, and I'm starting to deal with the heart issues that were causing me to, you know, to be drawn to these other places. I felt a freedom to be able to just say no. And my love for my wife won out more than what this person is going to think of me. And I realized in that moment what had been driving me for so long. And when you're driven by those things, you can dress it up well. But I'm convinced most men, pastors are no different. We function as narcissists. But the danger of pastoral ministry is we can take what is sinful and turn it into a ministry virtue.
Oh, yes. You're right. That's
so
true.
That's a really dangerous place that we have. So, you know, we can, like you said, you can, so somebody could look at your life, just for your example, somebody could look at your life and go, wow, you are so dedicated to Jesus with all the stuff you are doing, you know, and trying to finish school and pastor and, you know, podcast, all these kind of things. Somebody could look at you and just praise you for that, and have no idea that of the text your wife sent you, and right. what might be behind the rat race you're in, and her kind words to be able to remind you of that. But some of the best advice I've ever received is that there's always another ministry, and you only get one wife. And so I have tried to live my life and evaluate my day and my week and just the things on my plate based on that.
Yep. Well, we've been talking, for those who are not familiar with the book, we have been talking about the book, The Pastor's Family, Shepherding Your Family Through Challenges of Pastoral Ministry. Brian and Kara, did I say that
you
right?
Did.
Kara?
Yep.
Kara Croft wrote it, and it's really an excellent book. And we've really been talking about chapter one, where Pastor Croft lays out, you know, the demands of appearance, the demands of expectations, significance, friendship. Everybody likes to be liked. He talks about that, and who doesn't? I mean, let's be honest. We all want to be liked. We all want to be respected, and it can be very narcissistic. It can be a drug that just completely drains you from the reality that you have a wife, you have children, and they kind of get the second. They kind of get the leftover at the end of the day. And so we've been talking about this issue, and the resolution is that, you know, where is our heart as ministers, future ministers, men in the seminary who are training to have these great demands placed in their time, when I don't think either one of us are downplaying the reality that the call to the ministry is not like any other job.
Yeah.
There's never a time when you're off.
That's true.
The phone could ring at any moment. And I kind of have a joke. I was telling my wife, if the phone rings after midnight, it's never good news. But there's always that demands, and pastors' wives recognize going in that there's going to be a challenge in that whole reality, but the husbands need to recognize it as well. And that's really chapter two, or part two of the book, where your wife spends quite a bit of time writing about this idea that I don't recall saying I do to this.
Yeah.
And where she lays out, you know, her own struggles with these issues. So we've been really talking about these things, and the solution is the husband, the pastor, needs to recognize where his own heart is, and cannot find significance in these day-to-day things. But our identity is with Christ and what he's called us to do. And one of them is the pastor of church. But the other one, substantially, is we have a wife and children. And so Brian, how do you balance that? Now, you're very busy, obviously, and you have children, too. I mean, one of the things that I'm thankful for, and this is going to sound wrong, but I think people get it, is that the Lord called me to seminary into the pastoral ministry after my children were raised and grown and out of the house, which I look back and I'm very thankful for that, that was the way he chose to use to do it with me. But most guys don't. That's not the road they go down.
Yeah.
The normal road is in their mid-20s, they go to seminary, they start having children. And so how do you balance that? We talked a lot about the wife, but now throw the kids into the equation. What's the solution there?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the kids often become the casualties in a pastor's neglect, you know. And they don't, depending on the age of the kids, they just don't understand what's going on. But it's the cliche, isn't it, that, I mean, the pastor's kid grows up feeling like his dad loves the church more than he loves them. And so knowing that that's kind of the default, I think pastors need to be especially mindful of that. And they have to go the extra mile to combat that, to make sure that his kids feel like they are his priority. And, it's really a matter of, you know, there's a logistical side of this, is just making sure you have time with them, schedule time in there with them. So I think one of the things I talk about in the book is having individual time with each one of your kids. And that I was challenged by that. My kids were little, by a friend of mine who's not a pastor. He's a deacon in his church. He's a pharmacist. But he had seven kids. And so we went and stayed with him for some time. And he had this routine that he had 7 days of the week, so each of his kids, each had a morning. And every morning he got up early with one of his kids. And they read together, they prayed together, they talked. They had time one-on-one every week with them. And, you know, and then as we're there, he challenged me why I don't do that. Well, I had like three kids at the time, so he wasn't going to take any of my weak excuses. because he had double the kids that I did. So he challenged me, and so I took him up on the challenge. And went home. I said my youngest was a baby. But so I had four kids, and we went home thinking, okay, I'm going to try this, but, you know, this is going to last a month or two. And, you know, my oldest is probably eight. So we're going to do this a month or two, and they're going to lose interest. And I worked at a time. Evenings work best for us. I don't know about you. Mornings are just insane in my house. Nothing happens of quiet solitude in mornings for us. So the evenings, I set it up where Monday through Thursday, each one of my kids had an evening, and they got to stay up 30 minutes later after everybody went to bed and have that time with me. And we read the Bible together. We prayed. We read a book together that they chose. We sometimes wrestle after that. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff happen. But I started this thought they would lose interest, and that was the exact opposite of what happened. They became my biggest source of accountability in doing this. I mean, I have no problem admitting this, that there were some evenings where it was just a long day. I was exhausted. And I remember just fasting and praying in that moment that God would so move their hearts to where they would forget it was their night. So I just wouldn't have to.
Wow.
And Bobby putting them to bed, and my 4-year-old would say, "Oh, Dad, it's my night." "Oh, yeah, it is. Okay." So they became my greatest source of accountability. And I tell you what, that is, looking back on that, did that for years. And that is some of the sweetest moments I have with my kids individually. And I'm really grateful for the recovery of family worship now. I really am. So it's not a knock on this, but I will say that there's a big focus on family worship now, but I got a glimpse into each one of my children's hearts with them one-on-one that I did not get when we were doing family worship. And so I think just for the pastor, we spend all week having one-on-one discipleship meetings and having coffee and having lunch with all kinds of church members. I want to challenge pastors listening to this. Look, if we're first to have the priority to disciple and shepherd our children and our wife, then we should probably make sure we're having those one-on-one meetings with them too.
Absolutely. One of the things that I hear you saying, and I think is very helpful. And though I don't have kids anymore, and I look back on things, mistakes I made as a dad. I mean, it's just, they're innumerable. I was just talking with my wife about that the other day, and she was kind to remind me that, you know, the kids probably have forgotten the things that you didn't do well, and remember as they've gotten older, the things you did do well. And I'm just like, well, that's nice.
Yeah.
I hope that's true.
That sounds good.
It does, but one of the things that I hear you saying, and I think is very helpful, is that it has to be intentional.
Absolutely, it has to be.
And so put it on your calendar.
Yep.
You know, if you're an OCD wired guy like me who has to schedule everything, and Google Calendar is just everything goes in there, but put it on your calendar and say, look, this is the time, barring, you know, a giant octopus attacking the church. My wife if she's listening to this, is laughing now because that's one of my favorite expressions. If a giant octopus attacks the church, then fine. But if not, then barring that, this is what we're, you know, this it's Tuesday night. And so at 8 o'clock, I'm meeting with child X or whoever it is. And, that's what we're doing. And that's it. And, make it a habit. And, But I love the idea of it has to be intentional, because if we don't make it intentional, it'll never happen.
Yeah, that's the thing that I think should resonate with everybody listening to this, is it doesn't happen unless you intentionally do it. Like we say, right, you know, it might happen once a month in some, you know, fluid way, but the reality is the consistency of it just does not happen in our life if we don't plan it. So, you know, another thing that comes to mind to your question of, you know, how do you how do you deal with this in regard to your kids as far as the neglect? One of the other things I discovered, other than just meeting with them individually, is, and we're talking about intentionality, do things with them in front of them that show that you are intentionally putting the church side and focusing on them. So you can do that, but I think it's best to make them aware other than like announcing at dinner, okay, I am focused on you now. No, I'm talking about, I'm saying do something that shows them they are it at that moment. So here's an example. I was terrible at, so I take a day off every week. I take Fridays off. But I was terrible at, on Fridays I would answer my phone. And you know, just in case, you know, I needed to talk to somebody and say, well, call this person. And so my wife called me on it, and I'm thankful for that. And she, so we made an agreement. So look, okay, you can check messages. That's fine in case somebody's died or something, but you don't have to answer your phone. You're off. People need to respect. And I went, okay, that's a good point. And as I started evaluating other areas that I was just not being a good example and drawing boundaries on when I should, I used to have my phone sitting at the dinner table next to me in case, you know, somebody called and, you know, somebody died or somebody went in the hospital that I would need to know as soon as it happened. So one of the things I did is I intentionally put my phone away. I put it in the next room, but I left it on. And we'd been having dinner, and eventually we'd be in the middle of dinner, and the kids would hear my phone ring, and it would be in the other room. And I remember just sitting, and it would ring, and I just kept eating, and I was ignoring it. And all four of my children, like from the ages of like, you know, 12 to 5,
right,
you know,
right,
they all know what's going on and look at me and like, Dad, what are you doing? Aren't you going to?
Yeah, phone's ringing, Dad.
Dad, the phone's ringing. You better get it. It's going to, like, they're all like looking at me like, what are you doing? And I looked at them and I went, what? And they're like, your phone's ringing. I was like, it's okay. The phone can just ring. Aren't you going to get it? No, I'm having dinner with you guys.
Yep.
And I remember my daughter, who's really intuitive, she looks at me, she says, well, what if somebody's calling you to tell you somebody's died? And I looked at her and I said, then they're not going anywhere. They can wait till after dinner in my time with you guys. And I remember looking at seeing their faces in that moment. And I didn't realize it at the time, the impact that was going to have. Like, I wanted to show my intentional change of behavior. But from that day on, my kids, you could tell they really felt special and cherished in that moment of all things, just putting my phone away and not answering it during dinner. So I think we can get creative and really think of all kinds of ways for our kids especially. I think those kinds of impressions leave us a strong impression on them when we make those kind of decisions.
Yeah, I mean, as you're talking, it reminds me of the times that I go out to restaurants and go out with my wife, and it's like she has a cell phone, of course, and she has that dreaded iPhone.
Yeah.
Okay, never mind. We won't go there.
Yeah.
People that listen all the time, they're laughing because anyway. But then I look around the restaurant, and it's easy to look around and see other people. You know, they're having dinner with their families, and they're stuck to their iPhone, or they're stuck, and they got their phone in their face the entire time. It's like, hello, why did you go out to dinner? I mean, but then I look at myself, and it's like I'm doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there my wife is sitting across the table, and it's like my phone is more important. And it might not even be important. I might be checking Facebook, of all things, or Twitter, or whatever.
Right.
It's like, why? Why do we do that? And just as husbands, forget the ministry, just as husbands and wives, why do you do that? I mean, it makes no sense.
That's right.
But especially as pastors, when time is so valuable, and this is not to downplay guys who work in factories, and their time is valuable too, but you know, the demands are so real. Throw the phone in the other room. Don't take it with you. Leave it in the car.
Yeah.
As you said, if it's a crisis, the voicemail will get it. I'm going to be out back in the car in an hour, hour and a half, whatever it is. I'll get the message, and but reserve that time intentionally for wife, kids, and both.
Yeah, I think what pastors need to realize is that we want to be available for our people, but we are not EMS. Like, we're not the ones that are going to come do compressions on somebody if they have had a heart attack. I mean, this is something that just kind of, it hit me one day years ago. I was like, you know, I'm trying to imagine any pastoral situation that could not wait an hour from now, you know, and there's maybe a few, you know, like somebody's rushed to the hospital, they may die, you know, I mean, you know, a car accident or something, you know, and you need to get down there as soon as you can, or you know, or somebody is maybe called, you know, I mean, God forbid somebody's calling you because they're suicidal, or, you know, there's a couple of situations, but for the most part, on the daily grind of ministry, there is nothing that could not wait an hour until you're done with that time with your family, and then go check your messages. And it is amazing how much my wife and my kids are so willing to share me and give me up when they know that I have honored them with that time. And I wish somebody would have told me that early in my ministry.
Yeah. Well, that's really part three of the book. And you know, most, as I said earlier, most guys are going to be in that situation where they're going to have kids. You know, I'm reminded what the Apostle Paul said about, you know, marriage. And, you know, if you're going to be in the ministry, it's better to stay single. And I'm obviously I'm summarizing dramatically what he's talking about there. But I think, you know, as I was talking with a young man just last night about this whole subject, he's not married, would like a wife. And I told him, I said, look, you know, I've been married 28 years and the Lord in his providence led me to seminary after my kids were grown. And I look back on that and I'm thankful for it because it would have been a train wreck had I done it the other way.
Yep.
And I said, you know, you're not married now in God's providence. And I get the challenge, the wrestlings that go on with a young man who wants to have a wife. I get it.
Yep.
But seize the opportunity now that God has given you by his own intention, directly given you to learn, to read, to throw yourself into your education, all this stuff. Because I'm going to tell you right now, once you get in the ministry and you have a wife and you have kids running around, that you think you're going to have more time.
Yep.
You're not. You're going to have less.
Yeah, that's right.
And be mindful of these things as you go into it. Be honest with your future wife. This is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
This is what I think the Lord's called me to do. These are the challenges we're going to have, and be honest and open about that stuff. I told my wife 25 years ago when we first met, I said, this is what I like to do. And it didn't happen for almost 23 years.
Yeah.
But she knew where that road was heading. But remember that the road to the ministry goes right through your living room. And if you don't remember that, you're going to be lost. Your ministry will be destroyed, as you've mentioned. Satan is good and crafty at these kinds of things.
Right.
And you lose your ministry, you lose your family, you lose everything.
Well, my wife, you know, is really cleverly said that. I mean, she didn't want to be a pastor's wife. So when we got married, I was doing associate work and would have just arrogantly said, there's no way I'm going to be a senior pastor. I don't want to be a senior pastor. I don't want to preach and all this. And of course, the Lord did a work in me after that was certainly changed the trajectory of my life. But she's like, I already told you I didn't want to do this, you know. So there was a part of her that had to work through that. So I want to any pastor's wives listening to this who feel bad that they're like, you know, my husband wants to be a pastor. He is a pastor. I'm struggling being a pastor's wife. I just want to encourage you that's okay. I mean, embrace that. That doesn't mean that that's not what God wants for you, but acknowledge that it's hard. And it's something that you'll potentially have to grow in. But again, I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier, that ability to be honest and transparent and authentic as a pastor's wife. You know, it's okay to say, you know what, this is hard. It's, I often say that there's one harder place to be in a hard church than the pastor, and that's his wife. Because the pastor can fight for himself, but nothing good comes from a pastor's wife trying to defend her husband. And so she has to just sit back and take it. And it is the hardest position, you know, to be in. So, you know, my wife has done a great job in the book on talking about her own struggles with that. And, but the Lord has used her in incredible ways and has also used her to reach, to encourage other pastors. Right? Look, just be open and honest with your husband, and God has to do the work in him to receive you and accept you where you are. But if you can't be honest with each other through the difficulties of ministry, you're not going to last real long.
No,
they're too hard.
They are. And I love the idea and really the concept of allowing your wife to be honest. You know, create that opportunity. Cause you're right. As husbands and especially pastors, that whole image issue, that whole, you know, putting our best foot forward kind of thing, it's a real pressure. And if we're not paying attention, we're going to see our wives just crumble, right? Right? You know, it by the time they speak up, it's too late.
Yep.
Unless we tell them up front and they realize and understand that, you know, you can be honest with me. If you're wrestling, I mean, please tell me.
Yep.
And we'll deal with that. And, you know, in the Presbyterian system, as you well know, we have elders in the session, and, men, pastors need to be honest with their session and just tell them flat out, look, I can't work 24 hours a day.
Yep.
I have a wife, I have kids, and I need that time. And you guys need to be on call when I'm off.
Yep.
because I need to be off and I need to be with my wife. I remember a friend of mine who he was a pastor, and I called him on his day off, and which I should have known better. I wasn't thinking about it. And I called him on his day off, and his wife answered the phone. She said to me, she said, Bill, he's off today.
Yeah.
Is this an emergency? And I said, well, no, not really. She goes, okay, he'll call you tomorrow.
And I love
that.
Yeah, that's a pretty courageous wife. I wish more would be that way, actually.
Yep. And, you know, she basically screened his calls for him and on that kind of thing. And I thought to myself, you know, how do you creatively do that when now everybody's got cell phones? And I mean, it's just, it's harder. But I think what you're saying is give your wife an opportunity to be honest about the struggle.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Arguably the biggest gift a husband, a pastor who's a husband can give to his wife is that he is a safe place for her.
Yep.
To be able to say whatever she needs to say, including, you know what? I'm really not enjoying your preaching right now. Wow. Why don't you just call my children ugly? You know, I mean, how can you say anything worse than that? I mean, so, but think about it. How strong, how powerful is it for a man to be so secure in his identity in Christ and aware of his own brokenness of his own life and the struggles of his own life for his wife to say to him, you know, I'm struggling being at our church. I'm struggling being a pastor's wife and I'm not enjoying your preaching right now. For a husband to not take that personally. And just to receive her and say, okay, thank you for sharing that. You know, I accept you in where you are in this moment, and it's okay, and I love you.
Yeah, it's funny you say that what you're talking about, because I was, as one of the older students here at the seminary, I have life experience that some of these guys are just getting into at this point. Yep. They're raising their kids. And I have a good friend of mine who's now a senior pastor, and as he was getting ready to graduate, he and I would talk a lot, and he would just drop by my office at the seminary. We'd pray together and talk about all kinds of things, and I really valued his friendship, and I still do. And as he was getting ready to graduate, we went out to lunch, and we were talking about, you know, what's going to happen after graduation. He's got a cause of this church, and he started telling me how he was going to come up with these creative ideas for his wife to be able to listen to his sermons and critique his sermons and check these boxes and do all this other stuff. And he was just really excited about it. And the more excited he got, the more depressed I got. And finally I looked at him and I said, brother, don't do that to your wife.
Yeah.
He goes, what? Why? He goes, it'll help my preaching. I said, that's not what she's there for. She's not there to critique every word that comes out of your mouth. She's there to feed on God's word. She's there to learn and be edified by the preaching. And when you're standing up there, it's already hard enough for her to eject the reality that she's married to you.
Yeah.
And that she's there to feed on the preaching of God's word. Don't put that kind of pressure on your wife. And he was like, wow, I never really thought of it that way before. I said, she's not just your critique, you know, partner. She's also a sister in the Lord. And, she's going to critique you in ways other people probably won't. And hopefully honestly,
which is valuable for wife.
Extremely. My wife, often will, one of the things that she checks me on in my preaching is not so much the content, though that's fair, is tone.
Yeah.
You know, were you too harsh? And I'll ask her, was I too harsh? And she'll say, well, you know, she'll kind of get squeamish, and then I'm like, okay, the answer is yes. But, you know, and it's important for that to happen, but that's not job one. You want your wife to learn and feed and worship the Lord and worship, and that's what you want, but have the reality that she can be open with you when necessary, I'm not enjoying this.
Yeah.
You're killing me.
Yeah, the young guy, the mistake I see a lot of young pastors make with their wives is they function in so many ways, both in their family life and in the church, not with the idea that they're going to have a 30-year ministry. And that's why a lot of them just you know, burn out and fizzle away in a few years. And that's one of the things, you know, you have to relate to your wife with ministry and in such a way like you want her to still love you and love the church 20 years from now.
Yep,
30 years around, right. A lot of guys, you know, they just kind of put everything on their wives, including like critique my sermon and help me grow. Well, you know, that'll come just through conversations and stuff. But yeah, I agree with you. A wife should never be the have to carry the burden of being the chief evaluator of your, you know, yeah. of your sermons, and especially when, quite frankly, most men are terrible at receiving that well from their wife. So,
yeah, it's funny. My wife will, you know, usually the worst time to do that is 10 minutes after I preach the sermon.
Yeah.
She usually waits for some kind of cue for me, like when we're driving home, and the, you know, usually the cue is pretty obvious, because I'm type A, and I have no problem just speaking up, and I just say, so what'd you think?
Yeah, right.
You know, and you know, now I've given her the green light to be completely honest with me, and because I'm ready to receive it, but I probably wasn't ready to receive it 5 minutes after I preached it. So usually I get to a place where I've already processed things in my own mind, and then I say to my wife, so what did you think of the sermon?
Yeah.
And that's kind of green lighting her to say, hey, look, you know, you now have the freedom to speak, and I'm not going to, like, lop your head off if you say something I don't like.
Right.
Well, which often happens.
The consistent thing I've heard from, because one of the things I cherish are older pastors and older pastors' wives. Yep. There's just not many of them. And they're just gold to sit at their feet and talk to them. And one of the consistent things I hear from older, seasoned, wise pastors' wives, when I ask them what are the few nuggets that you would tell any young pastor's wife, you know, kind of thing, every single one of them have always said, "Don't critique your husband's sermon on Sunday."
Hmm.
And like Sunday night is not the time to critique sermon, even if your husband asks.
Yep.
Because he's being bothered by some things and wants you to say something that's going to help him resolve what he's burdened by. But a lot of times,
exactly right.
A lot of times you're just going to affirm what he's probably troubled by, and it's going to just make him mad. So that's just gold advice, though. It's like, you know, I'm exhausted on Sunday evenings. Like, I've just resolved at a certain point. Like, I can't have any kind of serious conversation like that. So save it for Monday, save it for Tuesday. It takes discipline to do that because it's fresh on your mind. And you want to talk about those things. It's almost comical, though, the amount of older pastors' wives, every single one of them have shared that.
Yep. It's great advice. And I know how I feel. I'm usually a train wreck Sunday nights, and the last thing I want to talk about is that. I'm already beating myself up enough as it is, and chances are good I'm fishing for compliments.
Right.
And because we don't know, because again, it kind of goes back to what you said earlier about knowing our own hearts. You know, it's like,
exactly.
Well, you want your wife to praise you. You know, you're looking for some kind of uplifting element, and then she doesn't. And then it's like, you know, you feel worse about it, and you kind of asked for it. So, well, look, we're out of time. There's so much to talk about when it comes to just the pastoral ministry and our families, our wives. But I think one of the things that at least I've gleaned from this, and I hope the listeners have as well, is that many of the listeners probably aren't going into the ministry. That's not their thing. Some are that listen that are going into the ministry, training, or are in the ministry right now. So one of the things I think we take away from this discussion is it has to be a conscious effort to shepherd our families, our kids, our wives. We need to schedule it. It needs to be intentional. That's one. Number two, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think most people are members of churches and have pastors, and they have pastors who have wives. Try to respect the reality that they're human.
Yep.
They're sinners. They struggle with some of the same things that you struggle with. And when your pastor's off, unless a giant octopus is attacking the church or attacking your life, leave them alone. Give them the space to have the day off, because most of the time they don't get full days off
right.
because of some issue or another.
Right.
And so help your pastors and their families with these kinds of things, and respect that. And, you know, you will benefit at the other end. If your pastor and his wife have that time, their family have that time, because then when they're working in the church and doing the ministry of the church, they're going to give that full attention there. They're not going to be distracted. And so that those are two things I took away from this discussion. Feel free to add, please, to what I just said.
Yeah, well, it's great. And I think the other thing to throw out there that every family, not just a pastor's family, but every family can glean from is even if you schedule the time, you know, even if you're, you know, OCD, put it in your Google calendar, as you said, if you're
right.
If you are not present with them, fully present with them, it can be even more frustrating than not being there at all.
That's right.
So I would just urge people, and this is true for with your wife, this is true with your kids. Both, you know, our wives don't give, they're not given enough credit usually how intuitive they are. And they know if we are distracted, or they know if they have our full attention and we're fully present and fully engaged with them. And I would say that that's something that, that has been particularly valuable that I have learned in the last few years, just trying to grow and understand how to love my wife and love my, and love my kids. That's true across the board with any Christian husband and father.
Absolutely. Well, well said. And, we'll have to get you back on to talk about some other issues related to the ministry, but I've thoroughly enjoyed just listening to your, it's really wise counsel. And I hope people take it to heart, whether you're in the ministry or not. Fathers, when you're with your family, be with your family. I mean, it's simple as that. Be with them. You're not at work anymore.
Yeah.
And we tend to find, as you mentioned earlier, men tend to find their identity in their jobs, whether they're working at IBM or pastoring a church. They tend to find their identity in their jobs. And that's because that's the way we're wired, right? But we need to resist the reality that our identity is in our job. We're Christians, our identity is in Christ, and he's given us a wife, a family, and we need to minister to them, whether we're pastoring or not. That's the reality.
That's right.
Of what we're called to do.
That's right.
But we'll have to get you back on and talk more about some of these things. But the book we've been talking about, and the one that I would strongly encourage, especially pastors to read, but read it with your wife, because it comes from both angles. But it's the pastor's family, shepherding your family through the challenges of pastoral ministry. Brian and Kara Croft have written the book. Many of you are familiar with his ministry, practicalshepherding.com. But take advantage of these resources. They're valuable, crafted, articulated, and very practical advice to weed through when it comes to pastoring. It's not an easy life, but it doesn't have to be miserable.
Right.
So take advantage of these resources. Really appreciate you being on, trying to talk about these things in a very candid way. And look forward to in the future. We'll have you back on to talk more about some of these issues, because I think they're things that we need to think about and explore as we seek to be faithful shepherds. Did I lose you? Are you still there?
I lost you a minute, but I'm still here. But yeah, thanks for having me on. I enjoyed the conversation, Bill.
Very good. Let me, before you jump off the phone, let me just bring everybody up to speed. Coming up on the program, we're going to have Dr. Murray Kappel. I think I'm saying his last name correctly. His book, The Heart is the Target. It's on preaching. What are we doing when we're preaching? What is our real goal? And one of them is certainly to reach the heart of people as they're listening to our sermons. And so we're going to have him on to talk about this book that he has written. It's very helpful. Practical work. Then Dr. Ben Shaw, he's the professor of Old Testament here at the seminary. He'll be on to talk about Bible translations. It's a question that many people have. I've heard it before. You know, what's the best translation? What translation do you use? You know, so why do we use the translations we use? And he's going to talk about those types of questions on the program. And then Pat Daly, he is the general manager of Banner of Truth, and that's the U.S. office in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He'll be on to talk about the Banner Conference that's coming up in May. If you are not going, have not gone to the Banner of Truth Ministers Conference that's held every year, then you're missing out. It is a fantastic conference. It's on my calendar every year. It should be on yours, especially if you're a pastor in the ministry. It is a great time of fellowship with other brothers to listen to great preaching. It is a fantastic conference, and I would strongly encourage you to look into it. Banner of Truth, it's just Google it, and you can get the information there. So until next time, when we talk with, who will we be talking with? Dr. Murray Kappel and his book, The Heart is the Target. We do thank you for listening to this particular edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. And God bless.